joy, I don't find that that pouring is in certain ways a neglected holiday. That we're so focused on the Shavuot Manot and having a good time and costumes and partying, and even if we do pay attention a little bit to what Purim is really about, we tend to focus on the story of Esther, Mordechai, etc. So I think this evening we'll have a little bit of a shift, an important shift, and talking some of the mitzvah itself, as we often don't talk enough about Purim. And it's a pleasure to introduce somebody I met when Ilana and myself had first met, because Ilana and Daphna were roommates on the west side of Manhattan, and Daphna, I think, was just starting at Columbia at the time, if I remember, and she's now was finishing up her PhD at Columbia University, but she's doing it in Israel. So it's the best of both worlds, where she was a Wexner scholar in the interim, and she's actually here as part of the Wexner foundation. She was in Los Angeles, and she spoke there last weekend. She's visiting her parents in Washington, so we're glad we could get her on her way back to Israel to come and speak in Toronto. She's a bright, young, dynamic scholar. I'm sure you'll be hearing more about her in the future. She is the mother of two young children, now living in Yerushalayim. Without further ado, she's a teacher of Torah, a teacher of text. We'll introduce her to give us a shiur.
First of all, thank you to the Kolod and to the Grand Thomas for bringing me here. Is the volume okay? As you just heard, what we're trying to do tonight is focus a little bit on three of the mitzvot of Purim. In particular, we'll try and understand a little bit more about Mishloach Manot, Matanot LaEvyonim, and the Seuda of Purim. Tomorrow, for those women that will be there, we'll actually touch on some of the reasons behind the double reading of the Megillah. But tonight, we'll leave ourselves with three of the mitzvot. And our goal will be to try and explain them, number one, within the framework, the context of the story of the Megillah, and try and place these mitzvot, if possible, somewhat into the plot, and see how maybe our observance of Purim emerges from the story itself, as well as trying to place these mitzvot into what we call other normative frameworks. We'll try and understand where these mitzvot come from. If you think about the way we celebrate other holidays, in some ways Purim has the most many obligations. Let's say a Seder, where we have on Pesach many, many obligations. We have the wine, we have the matzah, we have various things to do. They all take place, the challah, they all take place at one event. Right here, if you think about it, we have requirements. Besides the two readings of the Megillah, we have requirements that span the day. We have the Seuda, we have the Mishloach Manot, we have the Matanot LaEvyonim. You don't necessarily accomplish all of them in one sitting. So what we're trying to see tonight is how and if these mitzvot emerge from the story of the Megillah. Why were these forms of celebration the forms that were chosen for Purim? And maybe what other contexts they might be able to fall into. Some of you might have read, if you read the flyer, my actual area of work for my dissertation in Jewish history, I work on a group of commentaries to the Megillah that were written in the wake of the Spanish expulsion in the 16th century. So some of what we'll be doing tonight are some of the lesser known commentaries that I study who actually shed light on some of the themes of the mitzvot. So this is an area close to my heart and to my work. Let's start with what I brought in the first set of sources, what I call the Great Reversal. What we'll see here is a comment one of these 16th century commentators, Moshe Alshich, a commentator who was born in Turkey and lived in Tzfat and did most of his writing in the city of Tzfat and Eretz Yisrael, who tries to explain in general the mode of celebration for Purim as emerging from the actual story of what happened in the Megillah. And here's how he explains what happened, and we'll look at the verses that he brings to support this. And then we'll explore each of the mitzvot, the Seudah, Mishloach Manot, and Matanot LaEvyonim. He explains that in the story of the Megillah, right, source number one, Roman numeral one, source number one, v'tshuvatam ad Hashem, horu hachna'a be'arba'at varim ha'ne'amarim, evo v'tom v'tchi v'tseid v'na'ama v'chatuv v'chom medina. He says, if you read the verse that I brought in number two, that we'll read now, v'chom medina v'medina, mekom asher v'var ha'melot v'dato magia, this verse, we're told about this as the decree of Haman slash Ahasuerus goes out. hostages are going to be killed. We're told that the response was everywhere that the word came. Israel Gadola Yudin, there was great mourning for the Jews. The Tzom Ubechiyum Yisheid, three additional descriptions of the type of mourning and reaction. Sak Va'efer Yitzal Arabin, everybody put on sackcloth and ashes. So, says the Alshech, because when the Jews received the verdict that Haman had just written, the decree that Haman had just written against them, they responded with all these different forms of mourning, and he tries in particular just to count four, the Evel, the Tzom, the Bechiyum, the Mispeh. Therefore, he says, back to the third line of the first source, Al-Kain, Kasher Ra'ah Hashem et Onyan Vayatzileh Mitzaratam. Therefore, at the end of the story of the Megillah, when God saved the Jewish people, what did they mandate at the end of the Megillah? They mandated four forms of rejoicing to be parallel and complementary and demonstrate the reversal that had occurred, that their four original forms of mourning were now transformed into four forms of celebration. And if you look at verse, what I brought in source three, the verse at the end of the story, when they established the holiday of Purim, we're told, Alkein ha-yehudim ha-frazim ha-yoshvim ba-arei ha-frazot, ofin et yom ha-ba'atza l'chodesh adar ha-simcha u-mishteh v'yom tov, u-mishloch manot ish l've'eri. That when they established Purim, they established four modes of celebration, which are described as simcha, mishteh, yom tov, u-mishloch manot. Happiness, feasting, holiday, and then sending these gifts of food. So just the general framework that we could set up at the beginning, before we explore each of the particular mitzvot, is that the general mandate to celebrate on Purim is a fourfold mandate that includes four different ways of celebration, parallel to the four forms of mourning that took place at the beginning. And what we'll try and do when we explore each of the mitzvot, Su'udah, the feast of Purim, Mishloach Manot, sending packages of foodstuffs, and Matanot Avyonim, the gifts to the poor people that we have to give, when we explore each of these three mitzvot, we'll try and see how it's possible the origins of those mitzvot might actually come from the story of the Megillah itself, and if not, then what other frameworks they might fit into. So again, just trying to set out, up till now, a general framework that the way we celebrate and rejoice on Purim emerges from the story itself, namely that they open the story with four forms of mourning when Haman's edict was issued, and they conclude the story after the plot has been reversed with four forms of celebration and rejoicing. Now we'll plunge into the question of the Su'udah, the feast. This one, I think, is the easiest one if we have to try and explain, not related to the plot for a moment. We're talking what we call normative halachic terms. Right? How do we celebrate generally on those holidays? Right? We eat. We actually have halachic obligations on holidays to eat. Part of fulfilling the obligation of the Samach and the Chagecha on the three major festivals of celebrating and rejoicing includes eating, which we're told, Simcha Elam V'Basar V'Yayin, that a true celebration actually involves red meat and wine, and you can't just have get off with chicken. So on the one hand, that we are mandated to have a feast on Purim as a form of an expression of the celebration really is sort of a normative term, not a very surprising concept. And what we'll try and see is that even more so, when we read the story of the Megillah, it makes even more sense that a feast should be at the centerfold of our celebration. Right, for after all, the story of the Megillah opens with a feast. We'll read the verses that I brought in source number four. The very beginning of the story, we're told that first Ahasuerus makes the feast for 180 days for all the big people, the important people in the town, Shushan. And then we're told, Ubimot hayamim ha'ele, asa ha'melech l'chol ha'am ha'nimtziim b'shushan ha'birah l'migadol v'ad katan mishteh shivat yamim. That afterwards, he made a 7-day, a week-long feast for everybody, important, non-important, big and little, in the capital of Shushan. And this feast, in the eyes of the rabbis and the Midrashim and the beginning of Masechet Megillah, is described as a very negative feast. And the participation of the Jews is viewed here as something very problematic and extremely sinful. When the Gemara and Masechet Megillah tries to attribute why the Jews in Shushan suffered such a great decree against them, it offers two options for what their sin was. One of them is that they participated willingly in Ahasuerus' feast. We'll see, though, that feasting is only part of the story of the Megillah. So the story opens with this feast that we call a feast of sin, a feast of participation, by the participation by the Jews, of Shushan was a sin. But then as the story progresses, when Mordechai convinces Esther that she needs to begin to act on behalf of the Jewish people, together they come up with a plan that she'll go and approach the king, but she wants some preparation and some spiritual preparation for that. And what she asks Mordechai to do in source number 5, in the middle of chapter 4, she asks him, lift, connote, is calling the king in Shushan, go and gather all the Jews who are presently in Shushan. Create a fast, a 3-day fast on my behalf. Don't eat and don't drink. She says the servant. She promises that after this preparation period of the fast, basically she's willing to face whatever consequences happen. If I die, I'll die. But at least this way she says, I know that I have a whole group of people behind me. So where the story of the Megillah opens with a feast, a Ahasuerus feast in which the Jews participate willingly and sin, as the rabbis try and portray it. As the story progresses, and the decree has been issued against them, and they want to begin the process of creating a reversal, right, they now engage in fasting. And the fasting, we're told, who participates in the fasting? Who does she urge? Let's connote the call using Hanim Sa'im B'Shushan, who are present in Shushan. If you go back to the verse before that we looked at, verse 4, who participated in the feast? Well, it's that same word. The Chola Am Hanim Sa'im B'Shushan. So those in Shushan who feasted, and now we have those in Shushan who are fasting. And if you think through just the rest of the story of the Megillah, we meet feasts and fasts again. But the true reversal of the story takes place when Esther makes two feasts for Ahasuerus. So on a sort of thematic level, that we should celebrate Purim with a great feast is makes perfect sense. It emerges seemingly directly out of the Megillah. The Megillah opens with this feast of sin. We then try and correct it with this fast. Esther then makes two feasts for the king, at which the plot turns around, and the Jews end up, as a result of those two feasts, being saved. And therefore, our celebration, feasting on Purim, makes a lot of sense. It comes directly out of the story itself. In source number 6, I brought a comment by one of the commentaries that I study, who is in Tzfat and also in Bagdad, Abraham Salon. And he tries to put these different feasts that we just mentioned into this context. And he tries to suggest, however, that there are two levels, both to the feast and to the fast. If you look at the verse where Esther commands the fast, she commands a 3-day fast, and she's very specific. She says, "V'tzumu alai, make a fast on my behalf. V'al tochlu v'al tishtu." You think that sounds just repetitive. Don't eat and don't drink. And usually that's what a fast is, unless you're a Muslim, and then fasts don't include the drinking ever. But she says, fast, don't eat, and don't drink. And what he tries to suggest in source number 6, he says, the reason that Sarah specified both the eating and the drinking in the fast is because their sin in that original feast in chapter 1 also had two components. It had the eating component and the drinking component. It had the eating component that they participated. And then we were told in the verses in chapter 1 that v'hashtiyach adat ein omeh, that the drinking at Ahasuerus' feast was added. So to speak, the custom usually went on, and nobody was forced to drink more than they wanted to. Implication that anybody who did drank willingly, right? There was no coercion when it came to the drinking at Ahasuerus' feast. So Abraham Salom in source number 6 tries to suggest that Esther, when she was trying to mandate this fact of correction, to correct the original feast, to wipe out that original sin of participating in Ahasuerus' feast, so that maybe the Jews would merit salvation, that she therefore specified that they have to both fast relating to the drinking and fast by not eating in order to correct the two sins, the eating and the drinking, that they did at the Feast of Ahasuerus. And I think we can take this one step forward, that in our feast, right, we also have those two components, right? The drinking on Purim takes on a very different dimension than the normative halakhic category of drinking wine on a chag, on one of the three major festivals. But whereas on a major festival we're told that, again, happiness comes with red meat and with wine, we're not told anything about the extent to which you have to drink wine. It seems like a little drink of wine is sufficient in order to bring celebration. Whereas on Purim, right, drinking, we'll see some more comments about the drinking at the end, drinking takes on a central role of the feast. And if you think about it, right, again, we're putting it into the pattern of the Megillah. The story opens with a feast, which has both the eating and the drinking component. The drinking component being more problematic because that was done willingly. There was no coercion, yet the people drank. Then the fast to correct that in order to gain salvation, which was both don't eat and don't drink to correct each of the sins. Then Esther, we know, also makes her feast. And therefore, our feast, right, develops sort of the next step of the process. Our feast is a feast that celebrates the reversal of their fortune through feasting and fasting. But again, each time related to both the eating level and the drinking level. So while I think the Suddah of Purim is the easy to explain one, right, that fits into the normative category of a feast on a holiday, it does emerge seemingly very logically from the patterns of the Megillah, the feast of sin, the fast of tikkun, the fast of correcting, then Esther's feast at which the story has its twist and its reversal, and then our feast to sort of tie all the pieces together and celebrate, and both eat and drink to celebrate in a correct way. Well, the Suddah emerges, the feast emerges, we'll call sort of logically and organically from within the Megillah, the other two mitzvot, the Mishloach Manot, the Matanot Yamin, the giving of the gifts, both of food and of money, at first glance don't seem to emerge either logically from within the Megillah, and don't necessarily seem to match up to other what we'll call normative halakha categories of the way we celebrate. On Sukkot, you can't think of a parallel, you don't have to go running on people's doors bringing food, right? Now we have the modern concept of Sukkah, but that's a very, that's a different concept of people coming to visit each other's Sukkah. But on Sukkot, as an expression of Simcha, right, what do? We walk around the shul with our meaning, with our Kulav and our Chogan, as a theme in our Avot and our Hoshanos, and we say that that is an expression of our celebration. We don't go bringing packages of food to people. Pesach, certainly we don't. Right, Shavuot, you don't have a comparable parallel to that. Where did this Mishloach Manos come from? And what about Matanos Avyonim? In source number 7, we'll see an attempt to try and put Matanos Avyonim into a seemingly normative context. This comment by another person with the same last name as we just saw before, Salom, another Sfat commentator from the 16th century, he tries to explain the origin for Matanos Avyonim. And this comment, I think, echoes the language that the Rambam a few centuries earlier used when describing what Matanot Avyonim is all about. So let's read the comments in source 7. Also, Riflach Koral Inyanach Manot Halal. He says, we really need to first try and explain what these manot, these Mishloach manot, are all about. Marom Ziva Mahu Kru. What could they possibly allude to, and why do we have this strange custom of giving food packages to people on Purim? Bishlama Matanot Avyonim. He says, we have a big question when it comes to explaining Mishloach Manot. He says, the other mitzvah of Matanot Avyonim says, that's not so difficult to explain. Tzidkat Hashem Asu, what is that? That is a form of tzedakah. Kim Amar HaKasuv, as the verse says, V'samata V'chagecha, Atar HaLevi V'Hager V'chulei, Omnam Manot Yishlo'enu, Lama Lulu. So he says, the big question is to explain Mishloach Manot. Matanot Avyonim, the gifts to the poor, he says, that's not so curious and in need of explanation, because that fits into a very normative category. That fits into what we'll call mitzvah tzedakah, the normative category of tzedakah, which is connected to the festival. And he quotes the verse from Sefer Dvarim in conjunction with the festival that says very clearly that part of your celebration of the festival means including the poor and the orphan and the widow in your celebration. The Rambam in his Hilchos Yom Tov makes it very clear that part of celebrating Yom Tov is feasting and is celebrating and is providing all the needs for your family to celebrate, but it also includes the tzedakah dimension. The part of a normative halakhic celebration of one of the three major festivals includes giving tzedakah to enable others to also celebrate and fulfill their requirements, or to bring them into your house so that they can also take part in the celebration. We know this probably best in the context of Pesach, what we call Kimcha Tizcha or Ma'oz Chitim, where in advance of Pesach, we collect money in order to make sure that those who don't have will be able to purchase matzot and wine for the Seder. But according to the Halakha, also in the context of Sukkot and of Shavuot, we have this halakhic obligation of including a tzedakah component in our simcha, in our celebration of these festivals. So he suggests that perhaps Matanot Avyonim is really easy to explain. This is the Purim parallel to So that's halachic obligation of tzedakah relating to other festivals. Now he wants to go back to try and explain what about matanot mishloach manot. He said matanot le'evyonim is easy. That we'll call tzedakah. Okay, so what about mishloach manot? And now if you turn to the next page, on the top of page 3, he'll offer two very divergent explanations for maybe where mishloach manot comes from. In some of the later sources, we'll see some other attempts to explain matanot le'evyonim as something different or in addition to that normative category of tzedakah. But now he's trying to explain where mishloach manot might emerge from. So he says, "Afshar l'faresh b'tchilat ha'yom," he might be able to explain, "Shehu derech simcha, shema'asim b'chol yom sh'adam sameach b'chinuch b'nov o milat b'charav, sholeach migdanot u'ma'azanot l'chol re'av u'yuda'av." They must have had slightly different norms in medieval time. That if you are happy with your child's report card, seems to be the image you give, right? Or with the celebration of your child's circumcision. Not only did you make a feast, but what did you do? You sent out care packages to everybody. Let everybody know your joy by sending out packages. L'cha atar, and therefore now, at the end of the Polish story, b'hisha'aram l'chleta, when the Jews were left and saved as a result of the foreign story, therefore, their natural reaction when they were saved at the end of the foreign story was to send out care packages just like they did when they were happy about other events in their life. So for us, again, that sounds a little strange because we don't necessarily do that. We make a feast and we might invite people to come celebrate with us. We don't usually send people cookies when we want to celebrate some sort of life cycle or family event. But he suggests that, maybe this was a normative expression of simcha. It's just a regular way of celebrating. So for us, while we make a big deal about it, right, they must have done this in medieval times very often. So he says maybe mishloach manot really isn't that difficult to explain. This is a normative way of expressing your celebration. But now he tries to offer a very different explanation. He says, o afshar, tam hamanot. The second explanation tries to fit the theme of giving gifts with back into the story of the Megillah. He reads it back. He says, it's kiderek lochamim milchamot atzumot. We can understand these gifts just like we understand what happens when people, great fighters, come back from big battles. Shebaine hamilchama v'notzchim u'mechalkim shalal, hem mishalkim el shalal akul le'ohavim, kimo shematzimu v'zavim. What happens when you come back from battle successful with a lot of booty? You don't keep it all for yourself. You distribute it to your friends and family. Because when we saw that model in Tanakh, when we read the stories of the battles of David. Kena davar hazeh, haman hara katav v'chatam laharog u'shlalam lavoz. He says, same with the foreign story. When Haman gave his decree, not only did he decree that the Jews should be killed, but he gave the decree that their property should be looted. It could be taken as booty. He says, and at the end of the story of the Megillah, when the Jews had the plot reversed, not only were they saved, but he says, it's as if they regained their souls and their property and all of their physical property as booty. It's as if they now gained all this loot from the battle. Therefore, the gifts that they sent out to their friends at the end of the Megillah were as if they were sending out booty after the battle. So he tries to fit, and I think this is probably different than any of us ever thought about when you're making hamantash and you're putting together your baskets, right? He tries to suggest that perhaps where did mishloach manot come from? So he suggests two options. He says, one, maybe let's just put it in the normative category of simcha. Right? This is a normative way people rejoice, or maybe medieval people rejoice, that they send food packages to friends and in order to celebrate important milestones. So maybe he says that's what mishloach manot is about. But then he offers an additional explanation to try to put mishloach manot much more within the context of the Megillah. And he says, what happens at the end of the Megillah when the Jews mandate that to celebrate Purim, you have to send mishloach manot ish l'me'ehu? So what happens is the Jews just finished a big battle. A big battle in which they had regained all of their property and their souls, which were destined to become booty for Haman and all of the other Amalekites. And therefore, when they were rejoicing and celebrating the regaining of their property and they're not being killed, what did they do? They acted like warriors who When they come back from war with spoil, distribute some of the spoil to their friends and family. So these mishpach manot are an expression of their military victory and are like spoils of war. I think that's a different direction for us. In source number 8, again, another fast commentator, this one is actually a Kabbalistic commentary on the Megillah, he opens up by suggesting, he knows that many other commentators have suggested that the reason for mishpach manot is this spoils of war model. And he suggests, he says, it's in order to show that they had so much spoils of war, they had regained so much of their property, that they had extra. And that the sending to friends is demonstrating that if you had enough for yourself and you had so much, the victory was so great that you were even able to send out to others. But in source number 8, he tries to understand what matanot le'avyonim might be if it's something else than tzedakah. Right up to now, we suggested that maybe matanot le'avyonim is just the pouring parallel to the obligation of the three major festivals to engage in tzedakah to enable others to celebrate the holiday. He suggests in the second paragraph of source number 8, he suggests, ובעניין מתנות לאביונים, נראה היות הטעם, וכמו שהיו העניים בכלל הנס, so just like the poor people were part of the miracle of Purim, כך הם בכלל חיוב המשתה והשמחה. They also have the obligation to celebrate today with feasting and being happy. ואם אין להם במה יצמחו ויגילו, נמצאו מבטלים את השמחה. But if they don't have the means to celebrate, then they're not going to be part of the mandated celebration of Purim. ולפיכך נתחייבו במתנות לאביונים. So that's why we have an obligation of מתנות לאביונים. כדי שיהיה לעניים במה לצמח. Very simple obligation. It's in order to make sure that the poor people can fulfill their Purim obligation. And as a result of that, we find that every Jew will be able to fulfill the obligation of celebrating on Purim. And therefore, it says that it is much more than regular tzedakah because what it does for us is it enables the poor to also be able to celebrate Purim.
But wouldn't you say that the tzedakah and Shalosh Regalim is the same?
So I said that the tzedakah, that was my interpretation, right? The tzedakah, at least according to the simple explanation, is to bring them into your house, to include them, to feed them at your table so that they've also fulfilled their obligation. Right? But I suggested that we also have the parallels where we actually give them the means to do it on their own. Mm-hmm. So basically, this would be doing the same thing. Like this would be the Purim parallel, but he says it's more than simple tzedakah. It's tzedakah with the goal, maybe we could say like that of the festival, with the goal of helping them celebrate and fulfill the halachic obligation. So it's not just simply a handout that you could give today, right? It's a handout so that they can fulfill their obligation to celebrate on Purim. Right? And based on, I think, all of these comments about the parallel between Matanot Avyonim and the tzedakah of the other three major festivals, these are based on the Rambam's halacha, which he determines that when you're choosing your spending priorities for the mitzvot of Purim, you should allot the most of your spending priorities to the mitzvah of Matanot Avyonim, because he says that this, only this is, he says, she'en sham simcha gedola u'mefo'ara, elo mitzmoch le'vaniyim v'yetomim v'almanot v'gerim. So the greatest possible expression of joy is to cause happiness and to help others, those in need, be able to celebrate. So he doesn't, I think this comment, he doesn't say that this is a direct parallel to the other festivals, but I think it is. But so again, what we've seen is that you can, it's easy to put matanot le'avyonim into normative categories and say this is the firm parallel to the obligation on the other festivals to include the poor and the needy and those maybe without family in our celebration. But in addition, we have that element not only of including them in our celebration, but of funding them to be able to fulfill their own obligation of celebrating. Whereas Mishloach Manot seems not to have its parallel, right, in our celebration of other festivals. Mishloach Manot, we need to try and find external parallels for, right, from, let's say, the spoils of war image or this general expression of celebration, or we need to try and find internal, from within the story of the Megillah, perhaps, the spoils of war from that specific battle. So where have we seen up till now? We've seen that we framed at the beginning that perhaps just the general approach that we're obligated to celebrate in multiple ways on Purim comes from the multiple ways of mourning when they heard Haman's decree. But that the specific mitzvot can either emerge from within the story of the Megillah, or they might be based on other, we'll call normative models. When it came to the Suzah, we said that's the easiest to explain on both fronts. As far as other normative models, we celebrate other holidays by having Suzot, by having feasts. However, the Suzah also emerges very nicely from within the patterns and the text of the Megillah itself. The Megillah, after all, opened with the Feast of Sin. It then had the fast of correction that included both the not eating and the not drinking component, to correct both of those sins during the fast, during the Feast of Ahasuerus. Then the Megillah progresses and we have Esther's two feasts at which the decree is reversed. And therefore, the way we celebrate Purim normatively is by feasting with both an eating and a drinking component. So the feast is sort of, we said, the simple one. We've seen that up till now, Matanot Evyonim seems to have a nice normative parallel with the other three major festivals, that it is parallel to the obligation of tzedakah and of funding the holiday celebration of the poor. Whereas Mishloach Manot seems to have no what we call normative parallel in our other religious experience, but it might, we saw a suggestion that it might actually be a regular old medieval expression of rejoicing, namely sending out food packages to people to celebrate exciting moments in your life. Or that perhaps it actually does emerge more from within the story of the Megillah, namely that it is like spoils of war that you divvy up and you share with your friends and family to share your excitement and your rejoicing at the end of battle. What we'll see in source number 9 is an attempt very much not what we'll call Aldera Hapshah, very not based in a little straightforward reading of the text, but it's a more conceptual approach, a more drash approach. Source number 9 is a disciple of the Maharal of Prague in the late 16th century in Prague, Shmuel Nachshon Katz, who tries to put Mishloach Manot and Matanot Avyonim back into the story of the Megillah. And again, he does it in a not literal way, but I think it's a little bit of food for thought for us. He suggests in source 9, Tam Manot Shtayim L'Re'ehu, after all, the obligation of Mishloach Manot is to give two manot, two different food items, to one re'ehu, to one of your friends. So two items to one person. What could that be based on, he says? Zahayu remez Ahasuerus ve'osha Esther. This is an allusion to Ahasuerus, who is Esther's re'ah, Esther's buddy, Esther's friend, so to speak. She'asa lo shtei mishta'ot k'min shnei manot. Esther made for her friend Ahasuerus two feasts, parallel to these two food items. Kidei u'chaitza Yisrael, the goal of these two feasts that she made for him was in order to turn around his mind and the decree relating to the Jewish people. These two feasts are what brought about the salvation of the Jews. After all, these two feasts brought about the reversal. So he tries to suggest that what is Mishloach Manot? Where did we get this new construct that we don't have on other festivals? So that it emerges directly, organically from the story of the Megillah. It is our way each year of remembering the two feasts that Esther made for her friend Ahasuerus. Therefore, we have an obligation to send two foods parallel to the two feasts to one friend. Again, this isn't literal, but maybe this is an associative allusion that in our practice, right, we're not simply just doing some expression of joy, as we tried to see before, but perhaps that the mitzvah of Mishloach Manot really does come from within the story of the Megillah itself. Now, what about Matanot Le'Avyonim? And again, here he's working in the non-literal realm. He says the reason for the mitzvah of Matanot Le'Avyonim is L'Zichron Hanit, in order to remind us of the miracle, how so. Matanot shenichnu l'shnei avyonim, Mordechai v'Esther. This is because at the end of the story of the Megillah, Mordechai and Esther, whom we could describe as avyonim, as formerly poor paupers, received two great presents. How so? She'avyonim hayugo tosha'ah al-onyam shel Yisrael. Right? Why can we call Mordechai and Esther avyonim, poor people? Because, after all, they were pretty poor and despondent about the plight of the Jewish people. And what two presents did they receive? What two, so to speak, handouts did Mordechai and Esther receive? V'ashtei matanot hem Yisrael matana echad. One handout was they got the Jewish people back. They got the little reed, the salvation, the lives of the Jewish people. And the second one, ubei kama matana sheni. The second one, we're told at the end of the story of Megillah that that the king gives to Esther, he gives her beit Haman, he gives her Haman's household and all of the possessions of Haman. So he suggests that in order to allude to these two forms of the salvation of the Jewish people, that the Jews were saved, that was like one present that, that Mordechai and Esther received, and then receiving Haman's household, that maybe in order to allude to that, we have the obligation each year to give two handouts to two poor people. So again, trying to place the mitzvah within the framework of the Megillah. So again, I hope what we're starting to see is that we have two options when it comes to the mitzvot of Purim. We can either try and put them into normative other categories, right? And we'll look at the Yom Tov model. This is the Su'udav Yom Tov, the Sakan Yom Tov. In that case, we're not going to find a parallel for Mishloach Manot so easily. Or we have the option to look within the Megillah for patterns and allusions and associations that might lead us then to understand why Mordechai and the people of his generation mandated that we celebrate Purim in these particular forms. And we saw that when it came to the Su'udah, Su'udah is a central feasting and fasting is a central motif throughout the story of the Megillah, so that we should mandate an annual celebration by a feast comes rather organically from the way the plot unfolded. When it comes to Mishloach Manot, said that it could emerge as the expression of the spoils of war, which we gained at the end, or here in a more figurative sense, that it alludes to the two feasts that Esther made for her friend, her buddy, Ahasuerus. And in the case of Matanot HaEvyonim, if you want to take it out of that normative category of zakah, helping the poor fulfill their halachic obligation of celebration, then we would probably go along this more figurative approach that we just looked at in source 9 of the two gifts that Mordechai and Esther got at the end, with them being like two poor people throughout the story of the Megillah, and then having their reversal. In sorts of 10 and 11, I just want to sort of take us one step further. These two comments from the commentary of Abraham Sahalom, in the late 16th century, Safin and Baghdad, he tries to take the mitzvot of Purim one step further in history. And not only leave us connected to the plot of the Megillah, but leave us looking forward in a cosmic sense. And it's important to remember that the story of Purim fits into a series of paradigms that we've seen. Not only the story of the Megillah is a battle with Amalek, but we've had previous battles with Amalek, Haman being the descendant of Amalek. We've had the battle with King Saul, with Shaul and Amalek. We have the battle with the Jews of Egypt with Amalek, at which Hashem, and we'll read this week in Parshat Zachor, the battle of Amalek after the Jews leave Egypt, Hashem declares an eternal battle with Amalek until they'll ultimately be wiped out, and at that time, both the verses described and then the Midrashim and the rabbis expand on it, at that time when Amalek will be wiped out, that will be the time that truly God's reign on earth will be firmly established and accepted by all. So in that context, with remembering that the celebration of Purim should reflect the downfall of Amalek at the time of Shushan, we have the following comment. He said, you should know that Shemashek atal Mordechai v'chayem aleihem v'yot ufim et yom abasar v'yom chamishasar v'chol shana v'shana, says that which Mordechai at the end of the Megillah mandated that they should establish the 14th and the 15th of Adar each year as days of celebration, HaKavanah, the intent was says when Mordechai said we should establish Purim, he said we're establishing a feast and a celebration that will be a reference, will be an allusion to the ultimate downfall of Amalek later to come at the time of the Mashiach. At that time when Amalek will ultimately fall, not this temporary fall like at the time of Shushan, but ultimately at the time of Mashiach when Amalek will be destroyed, then God will be unified and firmly established as king on earth. Now, what does that have to do with the mitzvot of the day? He actually tries to connect it in particular to the drinking on Purim. He says, because Purim has to be a way to remember that what we're celebrating is not just that victory then in Shushan over Amalek, But what we're celebrating is the potential victory over Amalek at the end of days, in the time of Mashiach. Therefore, our celebration has to also do things that reflect that what we're really hoping for is a future victory. How so? He says, therefore, v'lachem, chivu l'vesume v'furaya, since therefore the rabbis mandated in the Gemara that when we celebrate Purim we have to drink until we can't tell the difference between cursed is Haman and blessed is Mordechai. Why so? Remit, he says, this alludes to a time, the Mashiach Yel Atid. This alludes to what will happen in the future at the time of the Mashiach. Because in the future, God will destroy death and all forms of suffering. And if you want to be able to have a taste of what Yimot HaMashiach, what the Messianic era will be like, when suffering and death and Amalek will all be destroyed, he says you can't really do that when you're living in exile. How can you do that when you live in exile? Built the other day, you stuck with my eyes. The only way you can try and feel redemption, right, and try and really feel what the destruction of Amalek and the destruction of death and suffering will feel like is, if you drink yourself into a stupor, you can't really tell the difference whether you're living in exile or in redemption between Baruch Mordechai and Arur Haman. Because wine has the capacity to make you forget all your problems and warm your heart and make you happy. So why the drinking, he suggests? Up till now we tried to say that the drinking fits into, number one, the normative holiday drinking mandate. The true happiness on holidays needs both meat and wine. And he said the drinking comes as our celebration of the correcting of the sin of the drinking of Ahasuerus's feast, and now we're correcting and celebrating properly. So here he tries to add another dimension, that really what we're trying to do by all of our mitzvot and Purim is to give ourselves some taste of what, number one, it was like in Shushan when they celebrated the downfall of Amalek. But more than that, it's to be able to conjure up in our mind what the world will be like, and what life will be like when the ultimate downfall of Amalek in the future and Messianic times comes about. And he says the only way you can get yourself into such a state when you live in exile is to drink yourself into such a state. And that, he says, is what the drinking on Purim aims to do. And then he adds, "V'lachem tiva Mordechai v'shloch manot ish v're'eyu." He says we can also explain v'shloch manot as trying to help us imagine that ultimate destruction of Amalek at the time of Mashiach. How so? Remez la'atid, she'yu kol kach hatzlachot merubot shelo yachpid ish al re'ehu klal. This free sending of gifts, just freely sending, I gave 30, I gave 100, mishloach manot packages, he says, is supposed to conjure up for us the bounty that will exist at the time of the Mashiach. And he actually then quotes the beautiful Gemara that describes the bounty that will take place at the time of Mashiach. And the image he quotes is a statement that says that in the future, at the time of Mashiach, Eretz Yisrael will produce gufka'ot, like sweet buns. Just freely, and this will just sprout out of the ground, and clay milach, and satin sheet sets will just be sort of sprouting up. Images of the great wealth and bounty that will just be around, and be around in Yimot HaMashiach. So he suggests that perhaps not only the drinking, but also the Mishloach Manot might be these expressions of not only our recognition of what happened then in Shushan and form the celebration to try to recall the plot of the Megillah, but they actually may be looking forward in history, and they may be trying to dream of the time when not only do we celebrate this small victory over Amalek in Shushan, but when we can celebrate in Yimot HaMashiach the greater victory over Amalek is called all forces of evil, when God's name will be won. And in order to do that, we literally have to drink ourselves into a stupor, because you can't feel redemption when you're living here in exile. And number two, we do these kind of called unexplained, non-normative acts like Mishloach Manot in order to try and remind ourselves of just how abundant things will be and how bountiful the world will be in the time of the Mashiach. Just, I want to just the end of the Megillah, we're told that Esther writes down the Megillah again, and it's pro-world. So that they won't despair from redemption. Esther said you have to write the story down, because this story offers a message of hope to Jews in exile from now until the ultimate redemption will actually come. And then these Jews will know the Yitzush Hashem Yitzbarach Yishlachach HaMoshiach V'Rav Yitzirem Yitzirem Yechoshach V'Tzamah V'Tagalus. And the goal of writing down the Megillah was to give Jews in exile throughout the ages hope and confidence that God will also send them a redeemer and salvation, and that ultimately V'Yishvu LaBetach Kulo Sha'anam V'Shaket, and that ultimately in the future they'll live peacefully and tranquilly. Because the original sufferings will be forgotten. So trying to suggest that the celebration of Purim aims to do more than simply commemorate what happened in Shushan and celebrate the miracle then, but rather that the celebration of Purim as a permanent holiday each year with a text, with various mitzvot that we have to do, means that we're supposed to look forward in history to the time when the Purim celebration will be one of yet many redemptive battles against the forces of Amalek. So where I hope we've gone tonight is from number one, just noting that the fact that we have multiple ways of celebrating on Purim and multiple obligations to celebrate comes from within the story of the Megillah, that there are multiple ways of mourning and of reacting to the negative decrees at the beginning of the Megillah. And that on some level, our celebration each year of Purim is meant to reflect the happiness that the Jews felt at the end of the Megillah when their own situation had been reversed. And that therefore, specific modes of celebration had been chosen, modes of celebration that reflected that actual turnaround that took place in the story of the Megillah. The transformation from feast of sin to fast of tikkun, of correction, to Esther's feast at which the reversal took place, therefore we celebrate by feasting, and in each of these feasts and fasts there's an eating and drinking component. Perhaps the Mishloach Manot, if we're trying to fit things into the framework of the Megillah, come to express our celebration of the spoils of war that we had gained at the end of the battle with Amalek. So just like spoils of war that we distribute to friends, here we're distributing packages of food. Then we saw an attempt to try and fit even Matanot Le'Evinim into the story of the Megillah, that perhaps Matanot Le'Evinim are these two gifts the Jewish people in Haman's house that the two poor people Esther and Mordechai had received as a result of the reversal. So on the one hand, we tried to suggest that we can read and interpret the various forms of celebration today as emerging from within the story of the Megillah, as looking back on what happened in Shushan and saying that each year in our celebration we do these acts to try and remember what happened then, things that come from within the framework of the Megillah. We also try to suggest that some of the mitzvot have very normative context. They are parallel to what we do on other holidays when we're commanded to celebrate. We have feasts, we're commanded to give tzedakah to enable other people to participate in their mitzvah. Only Mishloach Manot doesn't logically fit into that category. And then what we try to suggest at the end is that perhaps not only do these mitzvot of the day of Purim force us and encourage us to look backwards into history and to read the Megillah and find either literally patterns and motifs that recur and are played out in the mitzvot, but also perhaps just non-literal figurative allusions to the mitzvot. But perhaps what really the mitzvot in our celebration of Purim is meant to do is not only to look back, but also to look forward in history to a time when ultimately Amalek will be completely destroyed, not just partially destroyed. And to do that, we need specific Purim types of commands, like the drinking into a state where we don't feel like that anymore, or the Mishloach Manot to express our abundance that we're anticipating at the time of Mashiach. Just the final comment that we looked at tries to see the whole Megillah as being a story that's meant to encourage Jews throughout the ages in exile. And that it's much more than meets the eye, and those of you that will come tomorrow morning will talk much more about this, much more than meets the eye dimension of the Megillah. The Megillah is much more than what seems to be the natural progression of events that takes place with power and ego and women and money at the centerpiece. And that it's a story that is very clearly driven by other forces, but that it's a story that we write down and we celebrate each year because it actually, even though it doesn't seem to contain too many religious messages, it It actually does contain great messages both of hope and of faith. Happy Purim.
If anybody has any questions, if I can ask a quick question.
Sure.
According to the last things you're saying on Matid Lavo, when Yom HaMashiach will have so much plenty, so how does the mitzvah of Matan Lachlev mean?
I think he doesn't particularly address that.
Right.
Yeah.
I realize.
Right. I mean, I think you could say that if that's an expression of, number one, how much we'll have to be able to give to others, that's one way to understand it. Or you could say that this one, Matan Lachlev Yomim and the Sudan, they're really still part of that normative Yom-Tov category. Right, they are the ways we generally celebrate. We have a feast and we enable others to celebrate. Whereas the drinking and the Mishloach Manot, they don't have to parallel. Those are the looking forward ones. That's right, he doesn't get that so clearly. Good question. Yeah?
Do we have any historic time frame from what period after the story of Purim the mitzvot were established?
Well, text itself tells us that right, that the mitzvah Mishloach Manot and Matanot Le'ev Yomim are mandated. Right, the text tells us, if you read chapters 9 and 10, in the end of 8, you'll see what they did the first year, and that when the second year came about, they had this decision to make Purim a permanent festival, and they included Mishloach Manot and Matanot Le'ev Yomim. Those come from within the Megillah. The exact proportion, how much you're supposed to give, how many people, those, right, the rabbis later on try and define. But the Megillah notes those two mitzvot.
I'm asking, and maybe there's someone here who remembers better than I do, that one of the reasons for Matanot Le'ev Yomim was that the Jews who lived in walled cities within the empire might not have felt as much fear at the decree that they would be wiped out because they had a certain level of protection. And that, in fact, the Matanot Le'ev Yomim were to show that even though you might have had the protection of the walls, there's still an understanding of
the very next explanation that tries to, again, link Matanot Le'ev Yomim as we practice it back into the story and tries to not understand it simply as that happens.
I'm wondering if this, like the dichotomy, these two different lines of Midrash, are found in commentaries like throughout history, or if this is indicative of like 16th century.
Right. So again, what I worked on is trying to show that some of these commentaries take a lot of the themes that appear in not only commentaries, but also in halakhic literature and weave them all together in their commentaries. Like commentaries in the earlier Middle Ages just have a very different style. First of all, they're much shorter, they're terser. They generally are either grammatically based or strive to put particular words or phrases into their contextual understanding. So the earlier medieval commentaries, it's not that these ideas are new to the 16th century, it's just that they're expressed for the first time in commentaries to the Megillah as opposed to in other genres. The earlier medieval commentaries are much more obsessed with trying to explain to you when it says Chor Karkas Ukhela, the different colored carpet that fills the walls of Haman's, of Ahasuerus's court. The earlier medieval commentaries are just much more obsessed by trying to tell you what the exact hues and colors and shades of these carpets were. It's just a different style of Prussian, it's a different style of exegesis, and a different form of, it's just a difference in the way they use the genre of Prussianus. By the 16th century, Prussianus, by biblical commentaries, become much more of a, quote unquote, almost a kitchen sink. They can contain, call it Jewish thought, they contain ideas in emunah and machshavah, they can contain much more halakha, and they're much more prosaic, so a lot of it just has to do with differences of style, use of the genre.
Is there anything about this idea, this struggle between contextual and halakha in the source and maybe normative? Is that something?
No, and again, I don't think any of these commentators are trying to mandate normative halakha, but they use the genre of commentary so much more broadly that they can incorporate things that appear in 12th, 13th century more halakhic works, like Abudraham and the Kolbo, right? Things that appear there will appear in their commentaries. It's just a different use of the genre and a broader use.
Is there any, is the political situation at the time reflected in these?
Sure. What I focus on is that, like these last two comments that we alluded to refer to, right? I work on a group of commentaries, 20-some commentaries, that were written in the wake of the expulsion from Spain, the first 70 years after the expulsion, when the key issue in Jewish thought at that time is grappling with the Luth and Gimelot. Right? Exile and redemption. Here, the Jews had just witnessed the literally the final emptying out of Western Europe of Jews, like the Jews have already been explained, expelled from France and England. Now from Spain and Portugal, 1492 and 97. This represented to them much more than simply an expulsion from a country where Jews had lived for thousands of years, but it represented the emptying out of Western Europe of Jews and the shifting of the center of Jewish life eastward, so the Ottoman Empire and the Arab Israel. And to Jews in the 16th century, both actually those who were expelled, as well as their descendants, as well as two, three generations later, these questions of what is exile? How do we get in there? How does exile work? What are Jewish people destined to do? Some of these themes we'll touch on tomorrow. Right? These are the central themes of the 16th century. What I explore is how these themes are reflected in these Esther commentaries. Because after all, right, of all the books in Tanakh, Esther is the exile book. It's the story that begins and ends with the salvation in exile. Right? We've got Jews who are hiding their identity, living in exile, assimilated into the king's palace. This is the story of exile. So what I study is how these commentaries grapple with this exile experience. So I think the comment that we ended with is a good example of how some 16th century Jews read the Megillah. They read the Megillah and found a lot of hope and a lot of messages that are relevant to them and to their co-generationalists. Like they said to their co-generationalists in the 16th century, read this book. It'll give you faith that exile is going to come to an end. Right, and that there'll be glorious ends for the Jewish people, even though today you might not feel that. So that's a good example of how 16th century Jews read the Megillah. We'll come tomorrow, and we'll learn a little bit more about how God operates in exile. Yeah.
At what point did the Midrash, I heard that there was a Midrash that in the Yemot HaMashiach, Purim will be the only holiday that's celebrated. And I was wondering if it came about in this period.
No, it's a much, much, much earlier comment, right? Comment that also has echoes in Halakha, through the writing down of the Megillah, question of the canonization. But yes, that comment says that in the future, right, all the other holidays will be abrogated, and Purim will be left. Purim will become this, so to speak, model for the transformation from exile to redemption. Because I think it's associated with the notion that I raised tonight, that in Chazal's mind and the rabbi's mind, the destruction of Amalek is equated with God's ultimate reign over the world. And that God, the Midrash says very clearly, which will, based on the verses we read this Shabbat in Parshat Zachar, Ein HaKiseh Shalem Ve'Ein HaShem Shalem, until God's name and God's throne, so to speak, will never be complete and full, until Amalek is wiped out. Right? And so in rabbinic thought, Purim is this mini version of it. So in the future, when we want to celebrate the downfall of all of our enemies, right, Purim is the holiday that will be left. Now what that means in normative context, right, has generated lots and lots and lots of literature over the ages, whether or not that means literally there will be no other holidays, what exactly that means. But it means that the message of Purim will be exactly what we'll be experiencing then in the future. Happy to have one more question, and then I'll happy to entertain over.
The notion of Chayav Adav Nifsume, something that, like, personally makes me feel very uncomfortable. That notion.
The obligation of drinking.
To an excess, to that point where we look at the Megillah, we look at Achashverosh, and we think how unpleasant that adherence to drinking is, and here the Chayav Adav, a person is obligated to drink. With the exception of the one comment that you made, mm-hmm. trying to put it into this, that that's the only way you can sense this feeling of the redemption, do the medieval commentaries that you deal with, struggle with the same
idea? My commentators don't generally, because again, their issues stem primarily from the text and then they jump outward. Most of the more halakhic commentators will try and deal with the question of, you know, keeping excess within limits, right? Dealing with the question of bounds when there's a command for excess. But I think it is just important to recognize that the element of drinking is such an integral part of the story that we have to somehow also celebrate. The question just is, yes, you know, high school boys getting drunk is a problematic experience, no matter what conceptual framework you're going to give it. And so that's not necessarily going to sit well with parents, educators, and community members, no matter what conceptual framework you try to give it. So I think, you know, no matter what framework you can try and put the drinking into, you have to keep in mind the halakhic literature, but also try to keep it into balance. and put it into a framework. And it's got to be part of a true celebration, not just drinking for drinking's sake. I'll have to talk to you about that afterwards as well. One more comment, and then we'll be free.
I was just wondering if you could comment on different interpretations about Amalek.
That's actually really a good topic for an entire, probably more than just 1 hour topic. It's a good topic for a book, and probably a mini series on Amalek throughout the ages. But certainly there's a split between trying to understand Amalek as a literal group of people, right, a racial group or a nationality that can be identified, and therefore talking about a physical destruction of a group of people, versus trying to understand Amalek on a more contemplative plane, on a thematic plane, Amalek representing the forces of evil and the forces that are antithetical towards God's reign being made known in the world. And in that case, right, these images of the command to destroy Amalek and the images of the Yimot HaMashiach being dominated or represented by the ultimate destruction of Amalek, those are talking about the downfall of evil and the ultimate recognition of God. So that's sort of the big split. And clearly the ethical questions of how you could be commanded to destroy a nation or a racial group of people, so that explanation comes packed with, you know, that direction comes packed with its own ethical and moral questions, which commentators throughout the ages have addressed, as well as contemporary writers. I think that if you do, you'll probably find two or three good articles in English on the web by some contemporary people that have written. If you do a little bit of a search, you'll probably find some very good articles that you could read that will summarize some of the literature. But that's a great topic for a much lengthier discussion. For in some out.
Today was my day to bake home and fashion. And I was bemoaning the fact that the excitement had left. The children were grown up, and I was remembering when our kids were very little how much fun it was to be participating in the baking of home and fashion, and today it just seems like work. So I want to thank you very much for rekindling the spirit of Purim in me and for reminding me why we bake the home and fashion and the meaning in this whole labor of love. On behalf of Torah in Motion and the Karat, I want to thank you very much. And I would like to remind everybody that there is a women's workshop tomorrow morning, Purim and the Hidden Face of God, taking place at Ulpanat Orlat at 9:15. And I would like to invite everybody to please attend. And again, I thank you and invite you to have coffee.